What the hell are you?
Spawn.
I am vengeance. I am the night. I am Batman.
You should be down on your knees thanking me for not killing you where you stand.
The following is intended only for mature audiences. Discretion advised.
We're on to Spawn number 20. I'm going to read you the solicitation copy for this
one. Okay.
Todd McFarlane, The Deal. This is an issue told from the perspective of the evil entity who gave Spawn his awesome powers. Find out some of the clues to the mysterious situation that Al Simmons has entered into and exactly what he has given up to return to Earth to be with his loving wife, Wanda. Back on present-day Earth, Spawn gets caught up in the hunt with Detectives Sam Burke and Twitch Williams, who are hot on his tail. Will they confront Spawn face-to-face? Find out in this issue that we are sure you won't want to miss. Darn close to being a monthly, still only $1.95. So I'm assuming this must be the copy for 21. And 22.
Yeah, because that's not what we read.
So Spawn number 20 was ranked as the 27th best-selling comic of 1994. The story is Showtime Part 2, written by Tom Orzechowski and Andrew Grossberg, drawn by Greg Capullo and Mark Pennington, dedicated to Roy Thomas. And again, why Roy Thomas?
Yes.
Maybe because he was known as a period writer, or maybe he was a favorite writer of one of the two creators. I don't know.
Okay.
He did a lot of 40s-era stuff, or maybe early 20th century stuff, and I guess maybe that's a nod because it's Houdini. I don't know.
There was an issue with writers in Image, right?
There seemed to have been an issue there, yeah.
So, okay. So, here we go. So, this one we start off where Spawn really looks like Kato, and they're floating in this limousine that says S-Cape on the plates. And he talks about how are you making this car fly? He goes, I'm not making the car fly. I'm making reality believe this car is lighter than a cloud. So, he's trying to, I guess,
teach him.
There's no spoon. Yeah. No, there's no spoon. So, he's trying to teach him that he can alter, I guess, reality? Matrix. Okay. So, they're floating in space. They're chasing down the Ukrainian bomber kid. They finally find him, but Spawn really wants this kid, and he's waiting for him at this hotel or at the apartment that the kid lives at. Houdini decides he's going to go to this.
The Ukrainian kid that was messing with the homeless people.
Yeah. Houdini decides he's just going to go ahead and go to this magician show.
Hey, did they ever make a show for a Spawn action figure?
No. But, I mean, he looks like Kato, dude. I thought it was Kato for a moment. He's sitting there. He's hanging out in front of this thing. He's kind of pissed off. He starts having flashbacks about Terry and how they were buddies. And
yeah, they met in Monterey, California at a Russian language immersion school.
Yeah.
Al only passed the courses by reading Terry's paper. This is the thing that I'm really glad this happened, because for the longest time I've wondered, we know what the deal was with Al and Chappell. And we know that we repeatedly heard that Terry is Al's, like, was his best friend before he died. But I don't know how you reconcile the two, because we know how he met Chappell. I didn't know how he met Terry. I didn't know how far his relationship with Terry went. And so at least that's finally a clue. We finally know at least where the fuck they met.
Well, yeah, linguistics. Oh, that's true. I never thought about
it. Also, I think that maybe Terry was his best work friend, and then Chappell was his best otherwise
killing friend.
Or maybe the opposite. He could actually hang out with Terry and Wanda and stuff and do like real stuff, and then when he was off doing the wet work, then Chappell was
because Chappell's all about pussy and killing.
Yeah,
that's all Chappell right there.
So, or maybe it's
all day all night
shift from being that guy to being the guy that hangs out with the Terry and Wanda.
And he overhears a voice, and it's Terry, and he starts wondering why Terry is walking into the same building that this Ukrainian kid is, but he's being followed in by some Russian looking the handlers, right?
Yeah.
And they strike
post KGB world, I don't know what you call them, so I guess, you know, Russian handlers the way to go.
Okay. They punch Terry. Apparently Terry's fallen into a trap, and Spawn, this was kind of weird, very unspawned. Like, he jumps and he's like, leave him alone.
I don't know that it's so much a trap as that Terry's just ill-equipped to deal with anything that would have come his way, and something came his way.
Yeah.
Or he went looking for trouble, and trouble, you know, whooped you out of him.
Spawn shows up and he just starts beating the hell out of everybody with his chains. And at this point, apparently Terry got knocked out by being punched in the gut. So he fainted or passed out.
Ooh.
Yeah. And so Spawn is beating up on everybody, and he's like, you know, I'm not going to kill y'all. If it would hurt you more, I'd kill you. Okay, so apparently he's taking it real personal to touch Terry. Yeah. Don't touch his Terry.
Well, he makes a big deal that Al won't see Wanda widowed again.
True. Oh, yeah, that's true. He did mention that, too. Terry's knocked out. He leans him against the car. He notices then that the Russian, or what's his name again? The little...
Volokov. Or the... what's that? I don't remember the other kid's name anymore. Porsche?
No, Porsche's already in there. Volokov is going in there to ask him to work on his detonator.
Okay.
Because the detonator apparently was broken when they were bringing everything over. This was the weird part. Is Spawn listening on the conversation with his chains?
I missed that. That was the case.
There's a part where Spawn is actually Spider-Maning the wall, where he's literally stuck to the wall like Spider-Man.
Like the tin can tied
and then he has a chain that is up against the window. So I always, when I was reading this, I'm like,
and he's reading the vibrating.
Yeah, I was like, is he listening to a conversation through the fucking chains? Is this a new power now?
That's amusing. I did not catch that.
You did? Okay. I made sure to fucking put a mental note on that where I'm like, let me ask Frank how he feels about the fucking, what do you call the can to can conversation?
I'll take that over making a marble statue out of nothing. Definitely.
So apparently Spawn has a new Spider-Man power where his chains read the vibrations off the window and can transmit the conversation to him. He's listening on the conversation. He hears about they're going to blow up something or about the detonator. Houdini shows up, tells him how he missed a good show, and he's talking about, you know, hey, we're going to go to this performance with these tickets. Yeah, with the Powder University. We're at, again, Columbia University is where they were going to have this nuclear conversation.
Yeah, like a symposium or something.
So yeah, about the weapons and bombs and shit of the time.
Post-Cold War world, yeah.
And so we get there, and of course, the little shot, I keep forgetting his name, the little Volkov. Yeah, Volkov is just getting off on all the technology that's everywhere available to him, because in Russia, technology not good for you. Oh, I can't do what's his name, Smirnoff. Yeah, I couldn't do Smirnoff. But he's all excited, and of course the kid's like just laughing at him, like, leave me alone, old man. I've built so many detonators. So at this point, he's a serial bomber, right?
In Soviet Russia, you don't have technology. Technology has you.
I guess I'm not Europanned enough to pull that one off. Oh, Lord. The kid is definitely a fucking serial bomber now by this point. Where he's like, I've built so many detonators. So yeah, no more sympathy for this kid.
He wants to have a rep as the detonator kid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they go to this Columbia University. They're about to have their symposium. He's talking. He then brings out a case. He brings out a bomb. And I like that he said how half the crowd gasped in fear and the other was giddy with anticipation. I'm like, okay, that's today. So today.
No, nobody had their phones out.
True. But that would have been absolutely today. He withdraws a shielded container. It is enough plutonium for the bomb, which could level a good-sized section of the city. This city. And he basically plays in the bomb. The guys around him pull out their weapons, and then this is where he starts saying that I want $1.5 billion per kiloton of my device here.
Yeah.
So, you know, Terry's there. They pull out their gun. Spawn is there. Houdini pulls out a gun, too. The big, dirty, hairy 357. And this is where I got kind
of
confused.
Maybe act or something?
I got really confused.
Did he do the bullet catch or something?
I don't think Houdini ever did the bullet catch.
I'm just saying. It's an option.
Because then we're sent back to the overlap or overflap. And
why overflap?
I don't know.
The overlap.
Dude, looks like a giant vagina in the background.
Okay.
The overflap.
So the Arby's?
The Arby's of interdimensional space travel. He's acquiring all this information. They're all giving him information. This is where I was getting a little confused.
Well, the overlap still wants to know if you can nuke a demon. And the demon 9 hates Houdini. So they're going to try to do 2-for-1. Get rid of Houdini and get rid of Spawn. And
all at the same time.
Will and again, whether or not H-Bomb can blow him up.
We kind of skipped the part where they had given Houdini a device to let him believe that he could teleport. Because it was easier to use that device than for him to, because he can, apparently he can teleport, well, but he has to
I think the device allows him to transverse dimensions.
Yes.
So while he can.
No, he can't, but he has to meditate and it takes more out of him.
Right.
Where the device is just a simple click and he can jump.
Right.
And so he believes he's going to jump. So technically, Houdini's not really a friend as more of a setup guy because he knows what he's doing. He's setting up Spawn to be blown up. Though he's kind of teaching Spawn how to use his power. In a way, I guess he's trying to let Spawn know that you can survive this because your costume can survive this.
Well, no, I think you're giving him too much credit. I think what it is he's befriending Spawn and using his ignorance of his own abilities as a way of bonding with him so that he gets Spawn where he wants him to be.
You think so?
That's the way I'd tape it.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so the bomb's about to go off. This guy pull out a gun. They start shooting. Spawn protects Terry. Terry gets saved.
Well, what's important is that Spawn takes one in the face.
No, it's in the chest. Oh, yeah, it is. My bad. Yeah. In the face, yeah.
Because they had to have an in-story reason why he would have a facial marring that would be dealt with in the next issue of Spawn.
Okay, I did not know that. And then Volkov actually turns on the device to get everyone to calm down. You know, if they don't calm down, he's going to, you know, let it count down. They stop. He tries to turn it off. Turns out it's not going to turn off. That Porsche said, you know, it's a dead man switch, I guess, where it's going to go no matter what. Everyone starts freaking out. Houdini then decides. Now, wait, did Houdini catch the explosion or did he teleport the bomb?
He teleported the
explosion, right?
explosion, if not the bomb itself.
Because I remember they talked about how later on there's a scene where all the Geiger counters had gone off and read the radiation, and then they died down.
Yeah.
Okay. So he sent that into the overlap. Now, did it blow up in the overlap?
Yeah.
Okay. So you're gonna have to help me with this part, because this is where I got confused again. So the bomb blows up. Houdini does his teleport trick because the device they gave him did not work. So he realizes they were trying to fuck him over.
Right.
He creates a portal into the overlap, sends the actual explosion, the detonation, the energy to the overlap. Or I guess, so did he teleport himself into his box that was at the Magician's Club storage?
Perhaps. Okay. He survives. There's nothing left.
Well, he goes back in time.
And they make it look as though he had parrot.
Yeah. And he teleported back in time. That's the scene where they talk about how the other guy counters got off, but they died down. And the police, they pretty much can't prove a bomb went off.
Right.
Because all the energy, there's no destructive energy there.
So Portia gets arrested and he's seen on camera because they've got the reporter Spawn reporting on this event. And you see that little smirk on his face because he's happy that he's built a rep through whatever happened. But because there was no actual bomb, he ends up getting released by the authorities, goes back to his apartment, and waiting there is a confetti bomb from Spawn telling him next time it'll be for real, cut your shit out.
Then Spawn, he's like, you know we left the car here invisible. I can materialize the vehicle. He sees the vehicle. Oh shit, Houdini has the key. He creates a key out of nothing, at which point the car vanishes. And apparently that was one of Houdini's tricks or tests to show Spawn that he has the ability to manifest anything his mind is set to.
So he can shit out his own flying car.
Then they show the overflap and those Russian guys were teleported there. A lot of the overflap people were dead. I'm assuming those are their bodies. Overlap, my bad. Either way, it works either way. And they're talking about how they're going to experiment on these guys forever with radiation because they want to see how it works. And then we're sent to see Houdini doing one of his tricks where he's jumping out of a safe that was submerged in water. His assistant's like, where's his cape? Everyone's clapping. And then Houdini's just kind of...
So it's in the midst of one of his escape trick back in the 20s or 30s.
Okay.
Yeah. So this entire miniseries takes place while Houdini is supposed to be performing on stage. He goes into a disappearing act and then he has his adventure, and at the end of the miniseries he's going to turn up at the end of the act.
Okay.
So the original plan was that Tom Orzechowski on his own was supposed to plot out a Spawn annual, and that's what turned into these two issues of the Spawn ongoing series. Tom Orzechowski couldn't get the story written on his own, so he brought in help, and the 48-page annual became the two issues to help fill in the gap in the monthly book schedule.
Okay.
Several years later, a four-issue miniseries continued Houdini's adventure called Daring Escape. It debuted on September 23rd, 1998, the same month as Spawn number 75.
Oh, wow.
Which carried a five-page teaser story with Steve Lealoha inks. The first issue had a nice Art Adams cover. There was a two-month gap in between issues 2 and 3, and then over 3 months before you got to issue number 4. The first issue was drawn by Alan Weiss and Art Nichols. Afterwards, though, Jim Fern inked the rest of the miniseries. Once again, this was going to be a Spawn annual, but it didn't impress Todd McFarlane as being a Spawn story. So McFarlane agreed to bankroll the four-issue Houdini miniseries as long as they pretty much left Spawn out of it. When it was going to be an annual, it was going to be drawn by Gil Kane and Danny Meekie, but it took too damn long to cook the story, and we were deprived of that glorious opportunity. I'd have loved to have seen Gil Kane and Danny Meekie working on a project together, and especially a Spawn one. Alan Weiss is a fairly notable 70s artist, mostly at Marvel. I think he was one of the Detroit guys. I think he's buddies with Jim Starlin and Al Milgram, all those kind of dudes. He was also an old friend of Tom Orzechowski's. He was even an ex-roommate, and he was brought in to both do the art and help with the plotting. The miniseries starts with Harry Houdini gambling in the overlap with Joan of Arc and Judas Iscariot. Houdini's Little Red Demon Boss 9 requests that he go on a mission to recover the Hellite statue from the Spawn issue, because it turns out that this thing is created from pure evil.
Okay.
And it's like concentrated necroplasm or some shit like that, so 9, the demon, wants it.
And wait, what was the name of the series again?
Daring Escapes.
Daring Escapes.
Okay. Meanwhile, there's a fellow named Rodrigo Borgia, who's the president of the Dominus Sporting Goods Company. He's secretly Pope Alexander VI, who was made him immortal by this device called the Mummicardia. It was this artifact that had imprisoned both an angel and a devil. Houdini was on a mission in the Pope time period. He comes back from that mission. The Pope follows him through the dimensional portal because it wasn't closed properly. That's when he gets exposed to the Mummicardia, and then this Pope continues to live on for another 500 years, haunted by the angel and demon that are now within his body, imparted upon into him by the Mummicardia.
Okay.
A young angel named Camille is tasked with retrieving the Hellite bust, the statue that Spawn made. Meanwhile, Judas cuts a separate deal with both Heaven and the businessman demon Mahazael to recover the bust. Goons from the Spawn comics, those three guys or four guys, whoever they were, they've been hanging on to the bust this whole time. They just left it on the rooftop. And because this is concentrated evil, over time it's contaminated this whole building. And these guys are like crazy cannibals who kill some guys that the businessman Borgia sends to try to retrieve the Hellite statue. Eventually, Dominus sends troops, because he has his own religious cult, to retrieve the bust. And that's how they end up getting mixed up with Houdini. Houdini teams up with the angel Camille to penetrate the Dominus building building and encounters this hole. The Borgia uses the Hellite bust and a laser to finally remove the angel and the devil from himself and returns them to the Mummicardia. Zamzagil, Avenger of God, is sent to retrieve Camille, who they believe may be dead at this point, and to punish whatever evil destroyed her. He gets lost along the way because he can't figure out which church it is, because there's so many churches in Manhattan. He feels it must be a very pious place with all these churches. Ultimately, Houdini manages to shadow the Mummicardia, so the angel and the demon get loose again. They don't want to be parted because they've been together for so long that the angel and the demon now love each other, and so they help Houdini fight the cult. The angel Camille uncovers Judas's treachery and captures him and beats the hell out of him. The Pope's immortality fades now that he doesn't have the angel and the demon anymore, and he basically just crumbles to dust, and his soul gets taken to hell. Zamzagil finally shows up and takes Judas to heaven for retrial, which was Judas's whole plan, is he wanted to be retried for his crime, and he will be, but he's going to be like the trillionth person set for retrial, and they're only in the billions at this point, so he's going to be stuck in a purgatory in heaven for eternity, essentially. Camille is applauded for her efforts, so it was a great first mission for her. Ultimately, the little angel and the little demon, they're not like full-blown angels or demons. Hell doesn't care about them, heaven doesn't care about them, so they end up becoming sort of Houdini's pets. The remains of the Hellite bust, because it got melted by the Pope when he was getting the beings out of his body, when it was exposed to the presence of an archangel, Zamzagil, it just crumbled to dust, so it was no longer an issue. So when he gets back to the overlap, Nine's like, you brought me nothing, this sucks, you keep your little pet, just make sure you clean him up after them. The final scene is Houdini's back playing cards with Joan of Arc, and she asks him why he didn't take advantage of the portal to heaven and just go. Houdini demurs, what, and give up show business? And that's the end of the miniseries, and the last time we'll see Houdini in the Image comic books.
Okay.
The miniseries was different from the two issues. It had a much more Euro comic vibe. It read a lot like maybe some of Milo Manara stuff or you know, that kind of feel. It was fun. It was lightweight, you know, kind of thing. I remember issues of Daring Escapes just sat on the shelf in my comic shop forever because nobody gave a shit about the miniseries. They'd forgotten all about the Houdini connection. By Spawn 25, people were getting tired of Spawn, much less any ancillary characters.
Yeah.
And so I just remember looking at the covers of Daring Escapes just sit on my shelves. Like, oh, I think a copy of most of the issues for months and months, and they finally hit the quarter bins probably. So, but it was okay. It was cute, but it's not the kind of comic book that people really want in that time period. It actually probably done a little bit better today, but it's still too much of that like 70s Euro comic vibe. I don't think it would really play all that well. Alan Weiss is an artist that I like. I think Jim Fern did an all right job with the ink, but they weren't the best combination. I like both of them individually more than I like as a package. It was kind of a book
out
of its time.
You seem very about it.
It's just, it was a book out of its time. It did fit the Image flavor. It wasn't a comic book superhero type of thing. It was more of a Euro comics thing. It was just okay. I didn't hate it. It wasn't horrible. It was still kind of a long read. I didn't read it all at once. It was cute.
It was dense. Yeah, I was flipping through it. Yeah, I'm flipping through it right now. It's dense as hell.
Weird thing too is Houdini was kind of like, seemed like anti-supernatural for the most part in his real life. So it's weird they have so many supernatural elements to the comic book version. Plus, the comic book Houdini is way better looking than the actual Harry Houdini. Adrian Brody actually started a movie where he played Houdini. And Adrian Brody is a pretty atypical, you know, leading man. He's not like your typical handsome leading man kind of guy. But he's still way better looking than Houdini. But Houdini was in pretty decent shape. And it was just weird that they give you this fictionalized, glamorized version of all people Houdini. I got another solicit for you.
Okay.
Spawn Batman crossover. 48 pages. Yes, the rumors were true. Frank Miller is back on Batman. After years of waiting, we finally get to see Frank doing one of the characters that helped launch him to the top of Comic-Con's elite creator. You only need 4 pieces of information. 1. Miller. 2. McFarlane. 3. Spawn. 4. Batman. The book will sell itself. If you're looking for information on the story, here's a quick few lines from Frank. Drifters and winos are vanishing from the streets of New York City and showing up as cyborg zombie killing machines in Gotham City. The trail of horror and mayhem leads Batman on a non-stop collision course with Spawn, but don't think they're going to wind up his buddy. The artwork shown is not on the cover. And this is the art. It's very minimalist and not super. You know, it's basically a black silhouette of Batman and a red silhouette of Spawn and a few details so you let them know that they're not just abstract shapes. So a little background information. Spawn Batman was actually 52 pages for $3.95, which is a pretty damn good deal then and certainly now. It was released on October 11th, 1994. The book sold about 50% more than the average issue of Spawn, which was already the number one comic in the nation at the time. Spawn Batman was the number one comic in 1994. 4 in terms of dollar share, and it was still the number 2 comic in units sold. Besides Miller and McFarlane, you had Tom Wojcicki on lettering and Steve Olive's Ollie Optic. So this was a quality book across the board. You want to give us the story?
Now, reading this book, I have one question. I now question whether, did Frank Miller have help when he wrote his Dark Knight Returns books? Was that all Frank?
Well, one of the things they talked about was that the feeling in McFarlane's mind was that Miller was going to be a big draw, given how much weight of expectation there was on that, given how he did 2 Batman Class for the Ages within a year of each other, and you're asking him to go back to do Batman again. But he felt that the lack of editorial oversight would be a real plus to get Miller to do a Batman story again. And of course, Miller wrote and rewrote and rewrote Dark Knight Returns in particular over and over again, trying to get it just right. He just put so much of himself into making that book work. I think he was also coming off of the lack of success of Ronin. Ronin was not a particularly well-received book, and I think he had something to prove with Dark Knight Returns, and I think he was trying to do a masterwork, and he ultimately did. And then he followed that up with Batman Year One, which was not only a great story in script form, but of course David Mazzucchelli did incredible artwork for that as well. And in both instances, you've got Miller trying very hard. He's got a lot to prove. He's working with editors that would like, you know, the best work from him and are supportive of him and helping him, you know, to figure out what the story is going to be and everything else. And so this is Miller years later, after he's already been hailed as one of the greatest creators of all time. He's already proven himself. He's been off to Hollywood. He's probably been corrupted by the ways of Hollywood. He's made some of that Hollywood money. And this definitely feels like a paycheck gig that he was not.
Yeah, because this was just horrible. This is not Batman.
Well, it's
this is not Spawn.
Yeah, it's funny because Wizard Magazine in particular just mocked this book for years afterwards. That it was just trash and it did a lousy job. In rereading it, it wasn't nearly as bad as I thought it was going to be based on its reputation. And I don't remember if I think I'd read it in the past, or at least I'd skimmed in the past. I'm not sure if I actually full on read it before. And given its reputation, I thought it'd be a lot worse. That doesn't mean it was good, but it was. I thought it was going to be a lot worse than it was.
Rereading it, I now realize it was shittier than I thought when I first read it. I remember the first time I read it, I thought, oh, it's not bad. It's pretty good. Rereading this, especially today, it's bad. And it's not bad like, oh, you know, they just didn't get the character. The dialogue is so bad. Like, that's why I'm asking, like, how much did Todd have involved and how much did Frank? Did Frank just pitch an idea and Todd wrote it?
No. Don't put this on Todd McFarlane, okay? They talked about what ideas they had for the story. Todd had certain things that he wanted to have in the story, but ultimately he left it up to Frank to write it himself. He had no interest in telling Frank what he was going to write. The one thing he did do was he himself did not have much of anything to do with Denny O'Neill, who was editing the Batman side of it and was, you know, overseeing how Batman was going to be handled in the book. He said he let Frank deal with Denny, and if anything, McFarlane was completely hands off, and Frank did essentially the book he wanted to do within the confines of whatever Denny O'Neill put in front of him. So no, it's not McFarlane's fault. If you don't like the story,
it's all Frank.
You talk to Frank Miller.
Yeah, no, this is all shit, dude. This is a really bad. I thought the artwork was okay. It's I don't think McFarlane at his best.
Well, let me go off on a little tangent,
because I mean, first scene with Batman was just like this creepy smile. Like, this to me was just like, there was like no thought thrown into that. That was just something sketched real fast.
There is a lot of Batman in silhouette, and I read somebody was doing a critical analysis of the book, and they were pointing out that part of it might have been that he was trying to do a more of a Frank Miller style Batman, trying to reflect some of the things that he did in his earlier work, but also it might have just been a time-saving tool, because this is a book where he wants Spawn to look good and Batman to not look as good as Spawn, and since Batman is supposed to be this creature of the shadows, it was a nice little time saver to just keep throwing Batman in silhouette. He does it a lot.
Yeah.
Before I forget, because this is something I wanted for the Wildcats trilogy, so I forgot to mention when I was talking to Matt that we read Wildcats trilogy by Jay Lee, and we read the Spawn special, the Wildcats special with Travis Sherratt. And what I would not have expected, given how very different these two artists were, them using a lot of the same trick, because what they both would do was use a lot of heavy black, like solid black, and then have like cross hatching and other detailing effect come out of those solid black, so they wouldn't have to draw like detailed feet, detailed leg, you know. And it was so weird, because I never thought of those two being similar artists, but when I'm looking at those stories back to back, there's a lot of that where they're cheating, so they don't have to draw everything hyper detailed, especially in the case of Charest, where he's just putting tons and tons of cross hatching in this book, tons and tons of detailing in the book. Those solid blacks are probably what saved his life sometimes, and some very much the same thing is true of Jay Lee. And you look at somebody like Tom McFarlane, who did that a lot, and Tom McFarlane doesn't get fucked with as much about shortcuts he took, and I think it's because he knew what shortcuts take, and he did that consistently, so you didn't see the divergence in his normal style, whereas he was cheating. He always cheated, and it's probably what helped keep the work, the pages that did put detail in, on sketch. So it's just interesting that you had this similar thing going on, and it seems like the artists who were smart enough to know where they could cut a corner could keep a schedule better, where someone like a Brian Boland could never cut a corner, and he could never keep a schedule to save his life either.
Okay, so...
But it was maybe a little egregious in this book.
Well, like I said, I just really was not impressed with his art style at all. I thought it was okay. I mean, the first few panels, you don't even
see...
There's
some nice spreads in there.
No, he did splash pages. pages where he put work, but a majority of the book is just eyes and a, like grinning teeth.
Yeah.
And that's it. And I'm like,
the backgrounds are not bad though.
No.
It's probably easier to do backgrounds than it is draw a nice looking figure with a lot of detail to it.
I mean, for the most part, I don't think we see Batman's face until maybe the fifth or sixth page, and it's just a bloody nose.
And it's also a very cartoony face.
Yes.
So it's not necessarily an on-model Batman as you would like it.
Even the robot is not very detailed, like when he did Overkill. Well,
okay, if you're talking about the robot, you need to start talking about story now. Okay. Enough about, if you're talking about robots, you've gone too far. Okay, tell the story.
Well, the story is Batman, which, okay, wait a minute. So is Spawn and Batman in the same universe?
Here's the thing. Todd McFarlane,
Gotham and New York are in the same universe. Hold on.
Todd McFarlane and Frank Miller did a Spawn Batman jam cover. It was ultimately used as both a promo piece, I think he might have done a poster of it, and they had it as a cover to Wizard. And in this promo piece, we can see what Frank Miller contributed. He mostly did the Batman figure and a few elements of the Spawn, like the chain. So he kind of like helped with the design of the page. But it was McFarlane that went in there and drew two moons. There's a moon behind Batman and a moon behind Spawn. And I think it was Wizard Magazine in particular that made fun of the fact that there were two moons. And if you look in the actual book, the same image turns up on the very last page of the actual book as a pinup. And in that version, they've taken out the second moon.
Okay.
And I think part of this is because they were just fucking with the guy over doing two moons. Why are there two moons? But it could be that he was trying to insinuate that these are from two different universes. However, in the context of this story, it's written as though they're in the same universe. At least, like, the way that McFarlane phrased it in interviews was that these guys exist in the same universe with one story, and this story is not part of the actual canon for either of the company. Okay. So this is one, like an Elseworld. And in fact,
they joke at that. Yeah,
One of the bums
is like, what, like an Elseworld?
One of the homeless guys, like, making fun of Al because he doesn't believe the story he's telling him about, oh, you ran into a Batman, huh? And yeah, they refer to it as Elseworld. So even though neither of the book carry an Elseworld logo, that's the way they're supposed to be taken, even though for the most part, they're both within the familiar universes that as we've seen in the comic. And of course, McFarlane couldn't help himself. He threw in an element that would appear to directly tie into the actual Spawn comic book. So I would argue that Batman exists in the Image Comics universe, and this is the Image Comics Batman for however many times that he ever appeared.
Okay, I was just wondering, because I remember when I was reading it, I was like, wait a minute, they treated like, oh, I've seen this Batman guy before.
Yeah, they're familiar with one another.
Yeah, I remember that was very unsettling
for me.
Neither
one of them believes that the other, they both are in the urban legend camp.
But it was very unsettling to me, because it's kind of like, wait a minute, so you've known about each other and you've never really interacted? Like you.
Well, and that's the thing they make a big point of, though, in the book, is that Gotham City exists in the Image Comics universe in this story, and Batman's in his town, but this story takes place in New York and he's on Spawn turf, and that's part of the problem. Is Batman's on unfamiliar turf and it's Spawn's turf, and they're having a turf war over the course of this comic book.
I don't know, it just felt really weird. Batman goes to a warehouse and he's fighting some robot. He thinks it's Russian technology until the robot speaks with a Brooklyn accent, and he's like, what the hell? And he starts beating the shit out of the robot. He rips out a severed head that keeps telling him, I can't feel my legs, I can't feel my arms, and he's
just being used to control the cyborg.
Yeah, the cyborg. And the board, you know, it auto destructs.
It's a big Ed 209, basically.
Yeah, basically, yeah.
My understanding is that Frank Miller incorporated unused elements from RoboCop 2 script.
Oh my god, dude, he's recycling shit now. Yeah. That's horrible. And then
again, both Spawn number 11 in this book, for some reason, have to have these cyborgs. And I realized Overkill was also around too, but that was like a sort of a single cyborg character. Everything Frank Miller's done with Spawn so far has involved cyborgs, though. And
that's true, that's true. The gang, that's true. I wonder if that maybe was part of a recycled story arc from RoboCop.
Could be.
Holy shit, that explains why it was so garbage now. And then we're introduced to a woman, Margaret Love, who's the founder of like this, I guess, Heal the World organization. She's winning a prize, and we're in the Batcave.
Humanitarian
Award. I'm sorry. Again, this is a really goofy Batman, dude. Like, we're taken.
He's very cartoony.
We're taken to the Batcave, and it's
like the big jutting jaws.
Yeah. I see this, and I think Brave and the Bold cartoon Batman.
Yeah.
Like, it's
a shame he didn't act more like in the Brave and Bold.
Yeah. Like, but again, so, you know, and Alfred's like, sir, I got your tea. And he's like, oh, I don't need tea. They have this really goofy dialogue about Alfred really wanting him to drink this damn tea. And he's just like, patch me up. I got to get out there. There's these cyborgs out there. And he's like, well, the tea helps with nightmares. He goes, I am a nightmare. And I'm just like, this is what? Like, this is weird.
My understanding is that Miller approached this as sort of a year two Batman, where he's not as rough as
jaded yet.
But he's not seasoned either. He's been at it for a year or two, and he's very cocky. He's good enough now to where he's very, very cocky, but he's still not the Batman he would ultimately be. This still supposed to be a younger, more brash Batman in his view.
Okay.
Which is weird, because this is also a universe apparently where Batman and Spawn would be roughly contemporaneous to each other, with maybe a few year head start on Batman, which never plays well. If you're not treating Batman as a veteran hero in a crossover with an
he should always be the veteran.
That's going to be one of the problems that people are going to have with it, definitely, yeah.
And you know what? You're right. Anytime the good story arcs that I remember reading Batman is he's the veteran. He kind of has the no. When if he's your equal.
Yeah. If you're doing an early years Batman team up, it better be with a DC character like Superman or Wonder Woman or something. You know, somebody where it makes sense for him to be meeting them earlier in his career.
Yeah.
You don't
not
have
fucking Spawn in his 20s.
And especially when you're doing a crossover between companies, something that's going to be a rare thing that's probably going to happen once or thrice in this case.
Yeah.
You better be on model. And the problem with getting Frank Miller for this is he's specifically not doing an on model Batman, and it pissed people off. And honestly, this isn't anybody's Batman, really. If anything, I'd argue this Batman most resembles Mike W. Barr, who I think did a prototype of the Batman that Miller would have ended up popularizing. But I think that Barr actually kind of created that hard-bitten Clint Eastwood, you know, kind of version of Batman. And he's playing it to the nth degree in a way that's very grating for fans of the character.
And again, apparently he has this massive cape that's very Spawn-like. He's standing over New York.
Did make a point of trying to give each cape its own personality.
I mean, honestly, if you were to take the color out, you'd probably lose track of who's who without the chains. And even Spawn, I mean, even Batman makes fun of him about that.
The thing with Spawn is he always had this sort of like blind quality to his. They're almost like Venetian blinds. They have these all these folds to them. Where in Batman's case, you've got the scalp. And it's more rounded, more flourishy in that way. I don't know. So I can see what he could have been trying for. I don't know if the execution bears it out, though.
Well, of course, the news organizations, they're talking about how the Batman has been spotted. So they're hinting that we've seen Batman, you know, jumping around town. He overhears some homeless guys talking about Spawn. Al, they just keep referring to him as Al. Now, there's a scene when we're introduced to Spawn, he's flying through the air. There's a homeless guy asleep, and these two guys are going to set him on fire. That seems to be a go-to thing for Todd. Like, he's always having the homeless attack or set on fire or
but
shot.
Again, this is Miller. And that's Miller.
You're right.
But they're doing the whole, you know.
Because didn't they already do that?
Yeah, I think so. But also, we're doing the whole lighting a homeless person on fire, which was a real thing that happened in New York around this time period. They did a similar
What time
scene,
period is this?
Early 90s.
Okay.
They did a similar scene in the movie Money Train that got a lot of, I think it caused some heavy criticism at the time because they thought they were highlighting this incident over and over again in media. They thought they were going to create copycat, which thankfully did not happen. But yeah, these creative tribes did seize upon that and use it over and over again as a shortcut showing how bad he is. They like the homeless people on fire.
Yeah.
But the problem is, in particular in the case of Batman's dialogue, as written by Miller uses such dehumanizing language through Batman that none of the homeless people in the story feel like actual human beings. They all feel like fodder, and it feels like both Batman and, by extension, Miller sees them as less than human. They're treated that way, which is not very palatable to anybody reading from, especially from a modern perspective.
Oh, wow, I didn't catch that. That's a little heavy-handed, but okay. And they light him on fire, and apparently, as the flames are going, the flames do not act like regular flames. They actually chase the guys down, and it turns out it's Spawn. He's controlling them through his magic. He catches the two guys. The two guys are like, Gorky, you know, kill this guy. And so Gorky takes a couple of shots at Spawn, leaves bullet holes in him. Spawn then sets them on fire and tells them
they needed to fucking back off, run away, don't fuck with me. And they kept fucking with him. Yeah, they kept fucking with him, and he lit him up.
I don't remember that part, dude. It's weird, they man. Magic. So but Spawn's also telling him, you know, you're going to hell. Say hi to the devil for me. Like, yeah, okay. I mean, just, you know, when you see Satan, say hello for me. And it sets him on fire. Batman shows up. I did like the fact that, again, no face, just eyes and teeth as Batman is kicking Spawn in the kidney, which, okay, Spawn does that whole fucking...
regeneration?
Well, no. Batman does that whole fucking Sherlock Holmes, left punch to the right cheek, left kick to his left testicle.
6 months in practice.
Yeah, he does that whole mathematical shit. And Spawn just kind of turns around and kicks him, knocks the wind out of him. And Batman's like, oh, shit. Like, he should be literally crippled right now. He should be in traction for like 6 months where he can spend time in jail.
And then Spawn also used his magic to make himself more dense.
Did he?
So it's like
okay,
punching concrete.
I thought that was just natural.
No, Batman gets pissed off because Spawn basically magic spells.
Cheats. He cheats. Because he's like, it's like kicking a wall and punching a bag of cement. And Spawn's like not even breathing hard. And Batman's breathing. You know, even Batman's kind of pissed because he's breathing hard. And Spawn is just taking his pounding. He's just pounding the shit out of him.
So he goes to the utility belt and gases Spawn.
Well, no, but that's kind of goofy. He's like, damn it, Batman, you're an idiot. You should, you know, he talks to himself. He basically puts himself down for not using. And again, that felt really just weird, like Batman bitching at him. But when he fucked up in the other books, he would get punched, knocked down. He wouldn't sit there and be like, damn it. Well, I guess he did. It just felt really weird. He throws the boomerang and
feels off. Arguably.
The winner?
The voice feels off.
Yeah. Well, he's kind of bitching
at
himself.
It doesn't sound like Batman enough to, you know, and you really need to get that part down for Cross.
And, you know, he does gas him to escape. But it's even their dialogue, man. Had enough in your dreams. It's like,
again, here's the thing. There was an interview with all the creators involved in the project in Wizard Magazine.
Okay.
I thought for sure I had that issue with Wizard. I could not find it. I turned the house upside down trying
what
to
issue
find
is
that
it?
Thing. Like 32, I think it was.
It's
got it on the cover. But one of the things I think Miller talks about, if I remember correctly, was that he wanted them both to be young guys and talking like young punk trash talking, you know.
But again, Al's been through
maybe a young punk.
Why not just that? Al has been through military training.
Right. He's not a young punk either. Really.
No, dude, he's a, let's call him what he's a serial killer. Yeah. He's a serial killer, man.
Like, he's not a serial killer, but he is a professional
killer.
Soldier.
He's a killer.
He's a professional
assassin.
Killer.
Yeah. He's an assassin.
So he shouldn't be trashed on.
So he's not going to be like, in your dreams. No. He would. I see him more like a T-fucking 2000 where he doesn't say anything. He just turns back around and hits you.
Frank Miller decided what story he wanted to tell, and he didn't have regard for what character telling it was.
Yes.
He didn't give any thought to the actual characters. He just did what he wanted.
No, no, no.
Which he's been doing for years now, and that's why people can't fucking stand him anymore.
No, 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 no. He was just thinking about that check and how fast it was going to cash. That's all he
cared
about.
But I also think he had big dick energy in his own mind.
You think so? Yeah. Like, with dialogue like that?
I think he thought he was being a badass.
Frank, you've fallen so far, my friend.
Well, this is the beginning. Remember, this is when people first started to realize that Frank wasn't the guy he used to be. Because before this, he was doing Sin City, which was some of the best work of his career as well. And this was the first thing where his first myth.
Crack.
Wow.
The crack in his...
Yeah, where you start to see, get a sense that he isn't the Frank that we used to know.
Because you would say what? His great stuff is what? Dark Knight Returns, Year One.
Born Again, the Electra
Born
stuff.
Born Again. That's right, Born Again. Electra's really
some
good.
Some people really like Give Me Liberty. I never did read that one because it was never a big Dave Gibbons guy. But people seem to really like
Sin
that
City.
One. Sin City, of course, yeah. Sin and City was the last great one he did.
And then that's it, right?
People like 300. I don't. I think that book was trash. I've always thought that book was trash. But people like
Well, the movie's great.
I never saw it.
No shock there. Okay. So as Batman disappears because apparently he got his ass beat because he's really pissed off that he got his ass beat. It's really bothering him. Then Spawn starts puking, but he forgets that he doesn't eat, so he can't tell his reflexes.
Well, he says worse because he's doing it on empty stomach because gas, because his body doesn't know when to quit because there's nothing in there.
But that kind of bothered me because he's a corpse.
Why is he
breathing?
Yeah. Why is he breathing? Why? Yeah.
So I was like,
he talks. You've got to have the air in your lungs talk. So it kind of makes it you breathe too.
I guess that's a good point. I just assumed when he spoke, it was actually the energy speaking. Like, it wasn't him like creating. I have this crazy notion of a Spawn issue where, because again, in the book, Spawn is thrown forward in time. I would have loved to see where he was thrown back in time.
I'm not sure that he is thrown forward. I think he might have just been dead for 5 years in hell, you know?
Really?
He might not have been aware that that's where he was.
Because I think a cooler story arc would have been like, you throw him back in time and he sees Wanda's great-great-grandmother, but it looks just like Wanda. And as he moves forward, he loses his humanity or something like that. I don't know. Just something different, because they seem to really, I don't know, man, they're running out of steam with this shit. But anyway.
I don't think that they'll be able to control time. And I don't want him to be able to. I prefer him just being on hold to fuck with Spawn. Because if you give them control over space and time, then it's
no, not space, just time.
Even control time, then how do you? That's time travel. Where if you've got all the demons in hell going through time, how do you get? How does it?
That's why there's never the Great War, because they never get shit done. Bureaucracy at its greatest. Time travel. Okay. Anyway, so Spawn apparently can puke. Batman is up against the wall, licking his wounds, still pissed off that he got his ass handed to him. And I guess Spawn runs into something, or they told him there's a building where you go in but you don't come out. But
it's the Heal the World Humanity.
A junkie named
that's helping with people on the street.
Well, a junkie named Silvio led Spawn here. He seemed to know something. You can check in, says Silvio, but you don't check out. Okay, so it's just, we get two boxes to tell you where we went to the next, a whole arc of story. Like, oh yeah, he met a junkie. Don't know where he met the junkie, but the junkie took him to this place. And the junkie told him, "There's you go in, but you don't come out." So Spawn goes in there, and it turns out to be, I guess, a robot factory?
The Heal the
Cyborg
World
factory.
Mission is using the homeless, street people, junkies and the like,
but see,
as the raw material for the control.
But it makes no sense, though.
I know it doesn't, but that's
like,
the
why
story.
Would you? I would understand if you're putting the brains in there so you could recalculate them and they could be war machines. But you're just putting the head of a junkie in there.
Well, I think
RoboCop 2.
So
RoboCop
using
2.
The processing ability of the human mind to.
But see,
function.
RoboCop 2 made sense because you give the robot the drug which he wants to make him do what you want. They're still playing up on that junkie.
I never
aspect.
Actually saw RoboCop 2.
What?
Sorry, I skipped all the RoBoCop after the first one.
These are just full of
really
spite and hate.
I didn't even watch the shows, the TV shows.
I never watched the shows either. I watched RoboCop 1 and 2, and that's all I've ever seen. I've seen the third one once on TV. I saw the remake. It's not worth it. And I'm going to probably see the remake of the remake that when it comes out. Anyway, so there's a bunch of robots, and Spawn beats the shit out of it and rips its head out, or rips the human head out of it, because he's a badass in that way. They blow up the body, and apparently it's somebody he knew.
Well, he didn't want to. He was tired of using up magic, so he got a hold of the gun from the cyborg and blows him away with his own gun, which is typically what happens with a gun. But anyway.
Well, he knew the head, and the head talking to him. He's like, "I can't feel my legs, can't feel my hands, because you're a head." And for some reason, because the android blew up, it turns on a computer screen that shows the main villain talking about. Because he's like, "I wonder who's doing this." And then a computer screen turns on, and it shows
Dr. Margaret Love, the person who got the humanitarian war.
Yeah.
But also, it triggers memory in Al Simmons' mind of a woman named Nadia Vladova, who apparently was able to use some low-level mind control to have people get involved with, I don't know if it's ethnic cleansing or what, but basically just doing horrible wartime.
Like blowing shit up. Yeah, they
and
just
so
show.
He knew her in his Al Simmons days.
So he uses his magic to blow up the building. At this point, again, no fucking Batman face, just eyes and hands. Batman is healing himself off, and someone creates a poor man's bat signal, shows up, and it's Margaret Love telling Batman. Batman that I need your help because this crazy... What did she say?
Yeah, well, I mean, basically because of her powers, if she weren't an older lady and he wasn't the pillar of discipline that is the Batman, he'd have a hard-on for her. But as it is, she's able to smooth-talk him into thinking that one of the things that's preventing the world from being healed is motherfucking Spawn. Go kill some motherfucking Spawn for me. Yeah. He's like, I'm already on that shit.
Yeah, and so... Dude, I just realized we never really see Batman's face. This is really bad. I didn't realize it the first time I read through. Spawn is puking up his brains still. So is he still sick?
I don't know.
Okay.
The details are getting much. I skipped over a lot of that. I mean, I read it, but in terms of like taking notes, I didn't need all that level of detail.
Well, there's a guy there telling him to count his blessings that he's still alive. Spawn is still suffering from the effects of whatever. He tells him that I saw Batman. That's when they all make that joke about, oh yeah, you saw the Batman. Elseworld. What is this? An Elseworld? Ooh. He's pissed because he's like, I did see him. And then Batman appears, does, you know, his trademark bat symbol as he's coming crashing down on everyone.
Didn't he get like some kind of like super gauntlet to fight Spawn with?
Yeah, I think
Alfred sent it into him.
Yeah, I didn't notice it to just now.
Fight and fight and fight and fight and fight.
Yeah,
and fight
punchy, fight, kicky, fight, punchy, fight. Kicky, punchy, punch, punch, kicky, kicky, kicky. And Spawn's like, you gotta stop, you idiot. Which I was like, what? Like, I don't hear Spawn saying idiot.
Or Batman saying twit over and over again.
Yeah, so they're battling. Batman's still kind of kicking his shit up, but I think Batman has a bit of a hard on for him right now because he got his ass handed to him last time. So this is kind of where I got lost. I won't lie, as I was reading it, because somehow through this whole battle, where it says here, back when he was a soldier, back when he was alive, Al Simmons didn't need magic. And now with little magic to spare, he fights the way he was trained to fight. Dirty. And I'm like, okay, now he's going to fight dirty. Never mind, the magic was probably the best dirty trick you had.
Well, it was one of the things that pissed Batman off is he realized Spawn was holding back.
Oh, yeah, yeah, you're right. You're right. He kept bitching.
And Spawn was trying not to hurt Batman. It made Batman hate him even more because of that. And now we're seeing that Spawn doesn't want to waste magic. He's going to just fight him full on with his raw skills.
And so they're battling. And then at one point, I'm sure someone said Martha because they become friends.
Yeah. Just like kind of
Spawn. Martha. Martha. Wanda.
Yeah. And they team up to go after the cyborg.
Okay, but wait. What made them team up, though?
I don't even remember.
I'm looking at it here.
This is obviously shit, so why would you want to like pick through the turd to find?
Because I want to know. I want to know if one part he did say Wanda and he's like, how did you know my nanny's name?
Right.
How did you know her name?
Right.
Why'd you say that? And like, that would be such a great fucking connection. But oh no. So they basically, no, I remember how they became friends. They beat the shit out of each other so bad that Margaret sends the cyborg show up, right. Which is your typical science fiction trope of she's now going to give away her plan at the very end instead of letting Batman try to finish him off.
No. I actually think it's a really smart plan. She plays the two of them against one another. She until wears them both down and then she's going to kill the both of them now that they're down. The difference being that she underestimates Spawn, his healing abilities, his raw power, whereas Batman is still a normal human being, and Batman fucking basically get killed by the
Okay, so he did get killed.
He did. He was near death. And Spawn saves his life by using his necromantic powers.
I was going to ask you that. I was so going to ask you that.
And then Spawn uses his power to heal Batman, to the heal the fatal damage that's been done to him, and also psychically connect to Batman.
His mind.
So they're seeing each other's lives and how they ended up becoming who they were. Spawn thinks that Batman needs therapy, all this kind of bullshit.
Not in this Me Too moment. No. No means no, damn it. And Batman did tell him, get out of my mind.
Right.
And Spawn is still like talking, oh, your parents were killed? And just real kind of creep feel to it. I remember when I was reading also, that,
I just think it's an overreach of Spawn's power. Once you give him, like, he can heal other people and he can meld with them psychically and shit. It's like, and I know it fits McFarlane's selling point. His selling point was, what if you could have a guy who is at least as powerful as Superman, but it was only credit, and once he ran out of the credit, he would die, so he didn't want to die, so he has to lose as much as possible. So really, there's no reason why you would create a limit for Spawn's power. He could basically do whatever the fuck you wanted him to do.
So make him
so
God.
As long as you expose...
He's God. Huh? He's God, dude. He creates
until he runs out of power. But because this story doesn't have the Spawnometer ticking away, there's no clear reason why he would have a limit, and it just seems like an excessive expenditure of power for a guy who has been a tool,
who's been irritating.
Why would you expend that much power for a guy like Batman who doesn't like?
In this book, are they even bringing up the speedometer?
They don't bring it up because this is supposed to be an off-world.
Yeah. Okay.
And there is one thing that irritated me too is Batman keeps ulting Spawn's intelligence, and at one point he notes that he's dumber than Clark.
Yeah, I thought that was weird.
And it's like, and that's such a Frank Miller thing to do. He's always fucking shitting on Superman, and not only you're shitting on Superman in en route to shitting on Spawn. Have some fucking respect for the characters that, you know, the fucking industry is built upon, the icons.
You shit by association.
It's just Frank makes himself himself look like shit by shitting on other icons that ultimately in the grand scheme of things is going to be bigger than he is. Because I think that Superman and Batman are going to stand the test of time where Miller's already destroyed his own legacy at this point.
Oh, hell yeah. I just read his last Batman story, or the last
Master Race.
Yeah.
And that's not even him. That's fucking Brian Azzarello.
Really? You know? Oh, that was fucking horrible.
It's like an outline or something that Azzarello didn't follow very closely. There's just, it's not
okay.
Frank Miller.
I can't
it's
think
just,
of...
It's playing in Frank Miller's world with the intent of sounding as much like Frank as possible without being shitty like Frank Miller's today.
So it's that whole Before the Watchmen type bullshit?
Exactly like that, yeah.
Oh,
except that the author is signed off and catch up.
Yeah.
God. Doing variant covers.
Fucking horrible. So the androids attack Spawn. Spawn destroys both all the androids. He saves Batman, who I was going to ask you if he died, because I thought he was just mortally wounded.
Death. He was near. Well, mortal means you've got a lethal injury.
But I didn't know he died. I mean,
he didn't die, but he was near death and was saved by Spawn.
So then he came back through the power of hell.
Right.
So he's tainted now. That would be kind of cool. That would be kind of a cool story arc. You know, if you're brought back with the power of hell, your sins are magnified. And
another reason for it being an Elseworlds battle.
Yeah. See, we could write a better fucking story than this, dude. And I'm like half-assing this shit. And so Spawn does his blue magic thingy, and a giant ball lands on Batman, and Batman is cured. But of course, they're having, he's in his mind again. And apparently Spawn is seeing, what's her name, Love, like order assassinations and kill. And she smiled. She got off on the murder and the killing. At the same time, they're in Bat's head. Bat sees his parents get whacked for like the fucking millionth time. And I guess they decide now that they know that Margaret Love is the villain, they're going to both go after her. But they have two different techniques, where Batman seems more stealthy and Spawn is just kind of like a blunt instrument. Even Batman makes a point of like, how do you do all this shit with all them chains around you? Like,
how do you even carry those things around?
Yeah, so it's kind of like, yeah, it's a nice little swipe. Margaret's on apparently a boat, and it's loaded with enough weaponry to like level a country.
There's like old Russian nukes on there, and there's all these people in government, and the vice president's there, and she basically explains that humanity's the problem, that the world would be perfect except that humanity's destroying everything and killing everyone, and the only way to save the world is to kill
half the human race.
Like, to make a joke that the president wasn't there, but then the last caption is, arriving 20 minutes late, the president of the United States takes his first sip of the punch. His friends begin to fill him in. That's like the best line in the entire book, easily, because it is a haunting moment, because they've basically revealed to, besides the fact that Margaret Love, or Nadia Vlachnova, whatever you want to call her, she has her psychic powers, but you've also got the punch that's probably supposed to make them even more compliant to her, but they're also drinking the punch.
Yeah.
And she's a person who's trying to save the world by killing humanity.
Yeah.
The only way to save it. So I think that we're already seeing Frank Miller's hard right leanings manifesting. This is supposed to be like, he's supposed to be a lefty, and the president's drinking the Kool-Aid.
And I don't like to get it on your soapbox, but you know,
in Miller's case, there's this point.
Well, the right does believe before you can fix it, you got to break it. And so they got to break everything to fix everything, from what I've seen. Steve Bannon's mantra.
I guess. I'm thinking that somebody like Margaret Love is like a Hillary Clinton type.
Yeah, I thought more like Margaret Thatcher.
No, Thatcher was a right winger.
I know, but I thought that, oh, that's right. That's right. You're right.
Yeah.
She's the one that did the camps, the AIDS camps. Right. Like that. That's right. Okay. Because I was trying to figure out who she was based off of. I knew she was a villain, but I couldn't think of it.
I think she's sort of a Hillary, or sort of just like a left wing amalgamation with Frank Miller's proto. Because the whole thing is, he was very anti-censorship. And at the time, it was often the left that was involved with censorship. And so I think that started him on the path of being anti-lefty, by going up against the people who were trying to tell people how to better live their lives by mind controlling. I think that's what they're being inferred.
Okay. And so the ship full of weapons, Batman's stealthy, taking people out, and I guess Spawn's making fun of him because he's like, what's taking you so long? Because he's kind of just wrecking through the ship. And Batman does seem to have an issue with that, where he's kind of like, you know, you're undisciplined,
That's the one line he won't cross. He still won't kill people, probably because Denny O'Neill told Frank that it had to be the case. And so they keep referring that over and over again. Now, there is a line where they say that both men know what needs to be done. And so, again, you would think that what that means is that Batman realizes that Love needs to be killed. But when Spawn actually catches her, he's like, you didn't have to kill her, you know, this bullshit, you know, and throws a little tantrum and shit. And it's like, okay, sure, whatever.
But who threw the tantrum about her getting killed? I thought it was Batman. Okay,
speaking of dead man switches, she activates a nuke before she passes away.
Yeah. Well, they hit her with debris, and she gets impaled in like some debris. Yeah. The dead man switch goes off. The nuke gets launched. Spawn and Batman Spawn teleports them both onto the missile.
Which is one of those deep comic book things. How the fuck are you going to ride on a missile? Yeah. You know? That's one of the things I kind of like about Ant-Man and the Wasp, the original Ant-Man movie with the Wasp, is how they struggle using all their powers to hold onto the missile. Where, you know, typical comic booky bullshit,
they're just like holding onto it.
And I like there's a bit where Batman's looking at the bomb and saying, there's all these redondancies and this false contingency, and Bond's like, no, that's a trap. Those aren't redundancies. frequencies. I've seen this in my operations. It was one moment where they actually let Fallout look like it completed.
Yeah, you could actually see his military training coming through.
And then Batman disarms you with a scowl. He figures it out. He manages to deactivate the bomb, which is something that Al acknowledges he could not do on his own.
Jeez, they just keep showing his eyes, dude. This is so fucking... McFarlane was so cheap on this shit. And they kind of argue a little bit where, because Batman tells him, you know, you're undisciplined, you're dangerous, I'll be seeing you real soon. And Spawn's like, whatever. Like, and then Batman decides to fucking hit him.
Well, okay, hold on. The line is, Spawn is like, mine, can we just bury the hatchet? And Batman says, bury them.
And kills him.
No, he doesn't kill him. He throws a batarang in Spawn's face and it embeds in his face. And he's smiling when it happens. Like,
and kills him.
He doesn't kill Spawn.
Any other character that would have murdered him.
But he's clearly not any other character. He threw a batarang at Spawn's face and embeds in the soft zombie face that he's got. And Spawn's smiling at him the whole time.
And then thank God the end.
And now we know why Spawn got shot in the face at 19. Sorry, Spawn number 20. Because McFarlane wanted to acknowledge this damage to his face in successive Spawn issues to say this actually happened as a weak nudge, but he also made sure that it happened both in the Spawn ongoing series and in the special, so the reader could decide which thing caused Batman Spawn's face to be split for like 25 issues after this point.
Oh, is that the one where he had his face like tied up with a shoelace and shit?
Yeah, that's going to happen in the next issue. Yeah.
Okay, I remember that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, no, bull, fuck you. There's a whole fucking book over here taking fucking forever with your synopsis. Let me tell you every little line, every little time the cyborgs fucking shows up. Fucking skip some cyborgs. There's a lot of cyborgs. We don't need to delineate every fucking moment of cyborg.
Hey, every cyborg counts, damn it. Every cyborg counts.
Okay.
Cyborgs life matter.
Just a little bit more back information. So Todd mentioned other creators had announced the intention to do Image DC crossovers, so they'd already had talks with the company going back to San Diego Comic-Con 1982, the earliest days of Image Comics. McFarlane felt that it was way too early. They hadn't even launched Image properly yet, and he should be talking to the enemy about crossovers. So it was ironic that it ended up being McFarlane doing Spawn, Batman, Batman, Spawn was the first of the Image Comics intercompany crossovers a couple of years later. Frank Miller was Todd's first choice to write crossover. Basically, what had happened was he had talked to Frank Miller about whether or not it was even a good idea to do this. Frank said, yeah, go ahead and take advantage. And then Todd was, after the papers were getting signed, he's like, well, Frank got to write this. So he says, my guy, Spawn, is a dark, moody guy like Batman and Daredevil are. Besides, I've done Batman before and I always thought it was pretty cool. He tapped Miller to write it and the two of them kept quiet for 7 months. And they were both proud. Nobody knew about what they were working on. And Todd made a point of throwing shade at DC over the price difference and the fact that he wasn't going to use any cover enhancements on his book. There was a dollar difference in price between the two different companies' books. Mm-hmm. Even though the Spawn book actually had more pages, because besides the Jam pinup, there was also a two-page spread that Greg Pullo did. So the core story was, I think, 52 pages. And then there were also the additional pinups. So there was much more value in McFarlane's book with bigger name talent and more pages, more material besides. So he really kind of stuck into DC's, like, about having the superior book. McFarlane also promised that there was going to be a 6-foot Paul Standee to promote the book. That never materialized. DC actually put out Standee, but it was a little counter dump. There was die cut with their versions of Batman and Spawn. But I imagine it's probably because the market fell out over the course of 1993 and 94. And that's probably why that never happened. So we go over to DC Comics. They did the book Batman Spawn War Devil. This came out March 15th, 1994. So it came out many months before the McFarlane book did. It was the number two book of 1994 in terms of dollar share. So that number right behind Batman Spawn. But it only ranked number 20 in unit share. So that dollar difference made a huge difference in terms of the bottom line. The book sold twice as many copies as the same month Batman number 507, which itself ranked number 215 out of 1994's book. So again, Spawn number 19, which came out around the same time as Spawn Batman, was still a top 20 book for the year, where Batman's book was 215. So it made a much bigger difference having Spawn in a Batman book than having Batman in a Spawn book.
Okay.
So their version was written by Doug Mint, Chuck Dixon, and Alan Grant, three writers. They were working with Todd Klein and Steve Buscaletto. So the funny thing is, if the only thing the DC could really say they had more top line talent, big name talent, was they were gonna have the best fucking letterer in the business. God damn it, we got Todd Klein. There's no way you're gonna be with Todd Klein's lettering, and the lettering was definitely better in their book. But that's pretty much the only lover. One of the two, if Todd got Frank Miller for his story, DC would get their art from Frank Miller's inker Klaus Janson. So yeah, that didn't work out too great. What did you think about the artwork in the book?
I thought it was okay.
I hated it when I first saw it. I've never been a big Klaus Janson fan. Was one of the greatest inkers of the 70s. He could do stuff with Gil Kane. Most of the time, I think it's sacrilege to fuck around with Gil Kane, but he could do stuff with Gil Kane that made some of the best artwork he ever produced. And of course, Klaus was great on Frank back in the day, but Klaus as a penciler has always been too stiff, of too stocky. The figures don't relate well to their environments. I refused to read the Punisher series that he launched out of the Mike Zeck miniseries because I hated the artwork so much.
So honestly,
this one wasn't as bad.
Honestly, I like this art style.
At least he does actually draw Batman and Spawn.
What turned me off from this book, I remember, was the cover. I really didn't like that cover.
It's pretty weak.
Yeah. I remember when I saw the cover, I had no desire to read it. But when I was skimming through, I like this artwork. I like this style for what the story is telling you. It works perfect for the story. I liked it.
It does suit the story. It definitely looks like a Legend of the Dark Knight multi-parter. My thing is, I don't get off on seeing Klaus Janson draw Spawn. It just doesn't do anything for me.
And that's
half of it. Is he does a solid Batman. His Spawn's just sort of there. And I keep thinking, even though by this point he was pretty much blind, but I would have loved to have seen somebody like Jim Aparo's Spawn. Would be so interesting to see, although you'd have to have a really fantastic career to make up for his blindness. Or Jose Luis Garcia Lopez's Spawn would have been fucking rad. That would have been so cool to see. I would have loved to have seen, say what you will about the Image book, you had Frank Miller, who'd written some issues of Spawn. You had Todd McFarlane, who co-created the character and had drawn well at that point. Two of the biggest creators in comic. So you know that Spawn Batman was as spawny as it could be. The bona fides were secured. Where with Batman Spawn, you don't really get to see the DC version of Spawn, really. And if you do, it's Klaus Janson. That fucking sucks. And I'd just rather have seen a different, more classical Batman artist on the book. I think they were trying to be contemporary as possible, though. And so instead of having like a really cool classic DC feel, it has like a modern, we're taking whatever guys we can get kind of feel, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. So let me get into the story. 6 years ago, Colonel Al Simmons assassinated Simon Vesper. Batman saw it happen as he was investigating Vesper's shady business dealing, right? He was like a real estate developer. So years later, Vesper Enterprises erects the Gotham Tower, and that makes the news in New York City. So in his alleyway, Spawn gets hit by a newspaper that mentions Vesper and the Gotham City Tower, and he decides he's going to go to Gotham for answers. He remembers assassinating this dude. He remembers that from his previous life. Meanwhile, Matches Malone is investigating the crooked Virgil Dare's purchase of a Wayne Corp building. And Virgil has ties to the first British child born in America, Virginia Dare, on Roanoke Island, North Carolina, in 1587. And her birth signaled the mysterious demise of the settlement a few years later and the rise of the Croatoan. Okay. Now, this is a real thing.
I know. Colony. Yes. Yeah, I know.
You want to tell us a little bit about that?
There was a colony. They just vanished. They found these stones with like this strange language that they were never able to decipher. But these people just fell off the face of the earth. And they said they went to the town and the town was fine. There was nothing wrong with it. They just don't know why everyone left. It's just they walked away from it.
Yeah. And they did find a tree with the word Croatoan carved into it.
And they found, but also stones. There's stones all over that have these weird symbols on them. And they don't know what it has to do with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Virgil Dare is setting up basically a terrorist action where he's going to blow up one of these buildings. And in particular, they're getting paid to make the World Trade Center look like a firecracker, which is not a line that aged very well.
No.
So it's been a 6-year building plan on Gotham Tower. So basically, the foundation of Gotham Tower had the blood of Simon Vesper spilt on it by Al Simmons back when he was still alive. And now that tower is being cleated. Simon Vesper rises from an unmarked grave in Potter's Field, drawing flesh from surrounding life forms. Basically, there's like a cat or a bird around. Mm-hmm. He sucks into himself and he's going from a skeleton into, you know, like something out of Hellraiser. He's slowly building himself back up again off of this meat.
Cool idea.
Yeah. Vesper returns publicly and privately murders Dare, drawing a pentagram in his blood in the tower basement. Spawn attacks Batman at Gotham Tower, thinking he's another demon sent to haunt him. Like, they never mention Mel Bolger by name, but that's the inference. Mm-hmm. The symbiote suit prevents Spawn from energy blasting Batman to oblivion. And in fact, Batman just beats the shit out of Spawn over the course of several panels. Spawn never gives him any kind of fight. So it felt a little bit like the Revenge of DC Comics, that Spawn wasn't even relevant to Batman without his power. Neither one of these men know each other, so there's no connection at all between the two books. So you could argue that this was the DC universe Spawn, and that there is a Spawn in their universe, and that's how it would go down in the DC Comics universe. They make nice pretty quickly, and what's especially funny is they go to the Batmobile, and Spawn's like, "You have a computer in your car?" So given that we have so many car phone jokes over the years, mm-hmm. it's kind of funny to see that the computer in your car, what kind of fantastic science fiction thing is this?
I got a quick question for you.
Yeah.
Did Todd have any editorial control?
He just made sure that they didn't do anything too damaging to Spawn, but he felt like since DC was going to be mostly hands-off with his project, he tried his best to be hands-off with their project.
Okay.
So Simon Vesper at one point is watching people work on a computer, and he says, I like these lines, input, output, DOS and RAM, incantations or computerese. Every age has its dark magic. What's the difference between a curse and a cursor? And I felt like that was a little bit like what we had with Houdini and their two issues. They're basically, whether it's modern terms or ancient terms, they're figuring out ways to hack the matrix of reality, essentially. Using the computers, Vesper's able to knock out all the light in Gotham City. The only places that have light are his buildings, which of course form a pentagram around the city itself. It opens up a doorway to hell in his basement. Vesper was also hosting a charity benefit, so there are weird parallels between the two books. And he essentially starts eating the rich, turns himself into a giant giant redskin version of himself. He's basically looking to bring in more souls for the armies of hell, start the Armageddon War. So it gets into some of the stuff you were talking about. Vesper had actually hired Al Simmons to kill himself in anticipation of unveiling himself as a demon Croatoan. So he's this big green-skinned dragon. So everything is going according to plan. Now, he brought in Al Simmons because he could see the future and he knew that Al was going to become a Spawn, and he wanted to take advantage of that, having that alignment with Spawn later on. Also, at one point, Spawn is almost dragged to hell through that portal in the basement. Mm-hmm. Particularly, I think he still used Wanda, although they never referred her by name either, but he managed to fight that off because he realized he'd save everybody. In the old settlement, the Lost Colony, the Croatoan had given 100 souls to hell. Now he's wanting to give 100,000 souls so he can get his own little corner of hell. He wants to make his own little fiefdom within hell, and this is how he's going to pay for it. So he also raises an army of the living dead. They're mostly skeletons. They're supposed to go in there and basically start eating people the way he was eating people, theoretically, but it never happens that way. Spawn did break the pentagram around the city, but it didn't matter because by that point, the Croatoan had already opened the doorway to hell, so there wasn't anything way to stop him. In fact, Spawn says unfamiliar words to him, help. He basically is not used to ever calling for help, so Batman does help him, and it's a sign of, like, you know, Batman's a guy who actually is going to help people. So it's almost like they're consciously trying to show this is Batman the hero. This is not Batman the punk that Miller's writing. This is Batman the superhero that they believe in, the writers of this book. Ultimately, Spawn figures out the best way to defeat the demon is through love, and love will tear him apart. So he calls the power of his love and blasts him with, like, pure love energy and destroys the Croatoan. Batman talks philosophy at Spawn, and basically, you know, people are determined by the good acts they do and yada yada. And the final moment is Spawn realizing that Batman is the kind of man I'll be in my new life going forward. If they make Batman look like too much of a jerk in the Image book, I think they make Spawn look like too much of a wimp, and naive, Batman look too much of a shining beacon on the hill kind of hero in their book.
So they're almost like talking shit to each other through their book.
It was also, and again, I could not find the reference. I'd like to make sure of this, but I want to say other writers on the Batman book said that the only guy out of them that knew really anything about Spawn was Doug Mint. So they let him kind of take point on it. And it is funny because Doug does make a point of having a moment where Spawn, several moments in fact, where Spawn is just a total whiny bitch. And it's like, yeah, that's Spawn, all right. There is a little bit of lore to let you know that they do know Spawn. But one thing I did like was that they use the homeless in both books, but Doug Mint and the other Batman writers' portrayal of homelessness in their book is much more sympathetic than in Miller's book. And I like that about it. Obviously, there's a stronger story being told here, but it's still got its fault, and they still don't really get a good handle on Spawn. Aside from all the supernatural elements, it really doesn't feel like a Spawn story. It feels like a Batman story with this really funky guest appearance. And you definitely get a sense that people still don't know who Spawn is. They're still trying to figure him out, which is something we've seen a lot with his guest appearances. I think maybe McFarlane was wise to limit how many people got their hands on Spawn in the early days, because even though this is a couple years in, it still doesn't feel like people know who Spawn is yet and well enough to write him when they're not named Todd McFarlane or, you know, haven't talked to him directly to make sure they're on the right page with it. So.
Good point.
Okay, Project. I'm actually really curious to see the later one, because both the characters will be more established by then. I don't know who wrote that one, but there's another one that's like a decade later where they team him up again.
Really? Spawn and Batman?
Yeah. I think Greg Capullo drew that one.
Okay, we got to do that one.
Not immediately, though, because I think it all ties to the actual Spawn books, and I don't want to screw up the continuity too much. I considered it, but I thought we were already biting off a lot with this episode, so it'll keep for now.
I didn't see it on the website.
Or maybe it was promised and never came out. I know there were
promised and never came out, because this literally has every Spawn that ever came out, and I don't see anything here about that.
The 2006 project was going to be called Inner Demons and be written by Todd McFarlane. McFarlane has basically said that he just didn't get the job done on his end, and that's why it fell apart. You can see a number of promo images available on the internet, though. So, any last thoughts before we wrap it up?
Cash grab sounds mean, but it feels more like Frank did it on his end. This story seemed actually kind
of
cool.
It wasn't bad. It was definitely better of the two.
Like, it was more mature. It felt more of a mature story.
Yeah.
But I definitely get the vibe that Spawn and Batman should not work together.
I think sometimes you're better off with contrast. And I think that they're too similar.
This would have been cool if it was Spawn and Dr. Fate. Mm. Spawn and the Spectre.
Yeah.
That I could be like, okay, that's kind of.
The Houdini story worked better than the Batman story. Yeah.
They're just, I told you, I like Batman when he fights street crime. I hate when Batman's taking on gods. Mm. I just don't.
I used to like it when he did Superman stuff, and I just realized I like Superman's natural stuff, and it's cool when Batman gets involved with things that I already like, but it doesn't necessarily work for Batman. It's hard to do Batman stories after you've got him drawn into the supernatural stuff. It's hard enough to do it when it's superhero stuff.
Yeah.
But at least you can understand him going back to his more realistic, grounded Gotham City, when he's not off JLA. But when you actually have demons and the armies of the dead and stuff,
it doesn't work.
How does Batman work after that? Yeah, it kind of breaks the concept.
Well, I like him in JLA because he's the world's greatest detective.
Gangster? Yeah, what are you doing fighting gangsters when there are demons?
Yeah, so that makes sense. To me, I like Batman when he's the world's greatest detective.
He's the weird element in a real true crime universe.
Yeah.
The Nolan movies, basically. It's him and a few other elements are the weird stuff. Otherwise, it's a grounded crime story, like in the Nolan movies.
Yeah, yes, that stuff I like. But yeah, with him fighting supernatural monsters.
Or even going back to the Burton and Schumacher stuff, there's still these wild cards in an otherwise relatively normal world. Thank you.
I didn't realize how many Spawn books were out, dude.
Yeah.
How long has Spawn been out for a while? 20 years?
Getting close to 30, actually.
Really?
They're about to hit 300.
Jesus. I really didn't realize Spawn was out that long. Yeah, 298. Oh, and I read that last issue of Walking Dead. Yeah, he so fucking didn't know how to end his book. Yeah. That was such a cop-out book. I was reading, I'm just like, this is it? Like, that's how you're going to end it? What a puss. I think I'm going to stay away from his stuff for a while. If you're not going to give me a proper ending, I'm not going to give you my time. Didn't he say that for the longest time? I could write this forever. I have over 500 stories in my mind.
It's a long time, or near to 200 issues a long time. But yeah, he followed up the goal, you know?
Yeah, I think he didn't know how to end it. He absolutely... If you read that last issue, well, I mean, this one is like, well, he got killed by a bratty kid. Yeah. And came back as a zombie. I was like, and then Carl's like, well, I'm not going to kill you. I'm going to come and visit you, and I'm just going to watch you suffer. I'm like, Carl, you're a pussy, dude. Like, come on, dude. He killed your dad. Your dad came back as a zombie.
Kirkman stole his own, the ending from the TV show. They had Carl kill Shane on the TV show instead of.
Oh, no. Shit, I didn't even think about that.
Killing Carl. I mean, killing Rick, yeah.
Oh, Kirkman. You so disappoint. What's in your bag? What's in the bag, man? What's in the bag?
Just real quick, I want to do Spawnometer mail. We've got Lovin' from the 188 Sage, Adriano, All the Pouches and Image Comics Podcast, Andrew Farrago, Dr. Ange, Between the Pages, Book Promotion at HL Favorite, Cash Flag, Christopher Bush, Clarence Worley, Coffee and Comics, Dr. G Nerdologist, Ed Moore, El Romero, El Queen, Fanholes Podcast, Guts Last Sword, The Hammer Strikes, Random Geeky Stuff, Harmless Entertainment, History of Comics on Film, Iowa's Joe Crawford, J.K. Gordon, Jason Snicked Venable, Jeffrey Brown, Jorge Luinda, Justice First Dawn, Ken Stark, Kyle Benning Likes Comic, Matt Triano, Mix Yaspitalik, spelled as MX dot, Never Stop Player One, Odell Abner Dracula, Professor Frenzy, Professor Harbinger, Rad Adventures, Randy Caldwell, Relatively Geeky, Richard Field, Richard G, Schlocktopus Inc., Secret Wars and Beyond Podcast, Sean Merritt, Siskoid, Stockport Super, Wonder Woman Warrior for Peace Podcast, Xenozoic Xenophiles, and Zach Sally. Odell Abner Dracula wrote, Praise the Saints, a new Spawnometer drop. This was before I'd actually officially announced it. I just kind of put it out there. Il Mac over here wrote, I'm actually in this one. Odell followed, I'm rooting for you. And then noted, Frank, where did you first see Jay Lee? You, about to reply. Me, Odell, interrupting the recording, shrieking into my headset, inactive mic like a mental patient. Namor, say Namor. Cal Benning wrote, ugh, I don't like Jay Lee's art from this time period. That cover is vomit emoji. Andrew Farrago wrote, I interviewed Jay Lee at Comic-Con, and he pretty much disowns this period of his career, but it's fun to see all the hints of what was to come, and you can't deny the energy he brought to his earliest Image work. History of Comics on Film wrote, that moment when you are listening to Spawnometer and you start doing Val Kilmer as Elvis before they even bring up True Romance. And then he offered a video clip from that flick, and then he also offered a action figure drama diorama featuring Ares, where Marvel's Ares is saying, you know, oh, they're talking about me, and then the Wonder Woman movie Ares like, no, you had dumbass, they're talking about me, or something like that. I don't know. I don't have it in front of me. You got the gist of it. Finally, Richard G wrote, cool, bloody cool cover. Love Travis Charest, or not. We'll get into that. He killed it on his Sabretooth limited story run. Jay Lee is so dark and edgy. Thanks for the ad. Great image. Wow. I don't remember him ever doing Sabretooth, though. That kind of throws me off. And then I guess I didn't find them. Who wrote that? Or maybe I didn't get in there. Somebody wrote in to let us know that it's actually Travis Charvet, which, as you noted, Mac, that was our pronunciation was way wrong on that. But I also understand why a guy would fall off the face of the map and only work for Humanoids after having been a potential superstar in the making. A guy named Charvet would totally do that.
Yeah, I want to say that, like, if you look at, I want to say one of our potential pronunciations was like Charay, Charay. Charvet, I did not have, though. No way.
That, definitely educational. I'll try to find out who it was who corrected us and drop that in post.
I never use any of the cool FX on my mixer. So since I'm dropping this in post, I'm figured add some production value. It was Michael Wagner on the Facebook page that corrected our pronunciation of Charvet. Also on the Facebook page were likes from Keith G. Baker, Michelle Fife, DeBeige, Derek William Crabb, and Ryan Daly. And since we have neglected Tumblr, we got likes and reblogs from I Hate to Black Pepper, Zach Sneer the Therapist, Azul Alvarez, and our jackets work just like parachutes. We haven't gotten much attention on Tumblr in a while, so I don't know why the episode 19 got so much attention. But hey, glad you dug it.
Hello and welcome to the Magic Detective Podcast. I'm your host, Dean Carnegie, and this is The Magic Detective. So let me tell you a little bit about it. First off, this is an offshoot of my blog called The Magic Detective, which can be found at themagicdetective.com. Over there, I have 700 plus articles on general magic history. So you might find articles about Houdini and Blackstone and Thurston and Keller and you name it. I'm going to talk about Houdini. I talk about Houdini a lot. And you'll find quite a bit of information on my blog. So I'm going to be doing the same sort of thing here, but in audio form. And first off, you might be wondering, hey, who are you? Dean Carnegie. I've never heard of you before. Well, sorry about that, but if you look up Carnegie Magic in Google, you'll see a whole lot about me. I am a full-time performing illusionist, magician, escape artist. I do everything from close-up magic to big stage illusions. I'm a graduate of the Chavez College of Magic. Yes, there actually is a college for magicians. Please check out my blog if you get a chance, which is at themagicdetective.com. I'll be back every Monday with a new podcast talking about magic history and probably Houdini and other characters from our rich world. Oh, hey, subscribe. That's the most important thing. Subscribe to the podcast. That way you'll get notifications when the new things come out. And it makes me look better the more subscribers I have. It helps me out. And that's all I'm going to say about that for now. But thanks for listening.
In 1939, Bob Kane and Bill Finger created a shadowy crime fighter, steeped in the pulps and crime dramas of the time. That character was Batman.
Over the next 80 years, Batman not only became one of the most popular comic book characters of all time, but also became a television and movie phenomenon, appearing in both live-action and animated projects.
And then there are the plethora of video games, trading cards, action figures, and statues that have been made of him and his cast of characters.
Because of this, Mike and I want to spend the next year celebrating his 80th birthday.
And we're calling that celebration the Overlooked Dark Knight celebration of Batman's 80th birthday.
Yes. But really? Really? That's the best name that you could come up with. You've written panels, dude, and that's the best thing you could come up with.
It's accurate.
Yeah, but you know, you and I have been podcasting a long time now. That was the placeholder name. We can do better than that.
Okay, what's your idea?
Well, what did we call it in the first episode of this series that we've already recorded?
I really have no idea. It's a miracle that I remember what books we talked about.
Well, that's fair, because I don't remember that either.
Anyway, Andy and I are going to be spending May 2019 to May 2020 talking about Batman stories from all eras that we feel are either overlooked or too awesome not to talk about.
We're even going to have special episodes dedicated to things like the 1989 Batman film and what issues of Detective Comics we would include in a big hardcover collection.
Episodes will drop twice a month.
You sure about that?
To the best of my ability, episodes will drop twice a month at www.fortressofbaileytude.com.
You can also find the show on iTunes or through your favorite podcast app.
The Overlooked Dark Knight celebration of Batman's 80th birthday.
Because everyone is doing it, but we're doing it for a whole year.
The Overlooked Dark Knight is part of the Fortress of Baileytude Podcasting Network.
All rights reserved.
I'm thinking bat rankings.
Bat rankings?
Bat rankings.
Okay.
We are ranking Batman with a scientific approach. I mean, it's science. There's no opinion in here. We're laying down the facts.
Yeah, this is, I like this. Bat rankings. That's a good name.
Yeah.
We'll do it.
We'll do it.
We're talking about the true Batman.
Yes, the only Batman as far as I or anyone else is concerned.
Which is Batman the Animated Series.
Yes.
Which, to me, when I think Batman, I think the Joker, Catwoman, you know, Riddler is Man-Bat not up there.
Yeah.
So
yeah. I think I could fairly characterize this as discount Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Yeah.
It's why does the Man-Bat want to be a Man-Bat? I don't know. He's, I guess, evil.
maybe he doesn't have the stakes are pretty low. He doesn't have some grand plan to turn humanity into bats and create a master race of bat. He just wants to be a bat. That's right. His life choice.
And it's
and in this modern age of trans speciesism, I know we've got furries out in the audience. What I'm saying is maybe the villain is really the misunderstood tragic hero that we never knew.
It's such a character.
It's a lifestyle choice that Batman, frankly, should be more supportive of. It's 2019. Right? If a man wants to grow fur and wings and be a bat,
then let him.
They have conventions for that. People hook up.
What's your pros? You're the dick, not him.
Prude.
This is a fan-produced, not-for-profit podcast. No copyright infringement is intended, and any use of copyrighted materials believed to be covered under fair use. If you don't agree, you can go straight to hell!